Shalom and welcome everyone to this edition of the ICEJ webinar series. I'm David Parsons, one of the vice presidents here at the International Christian Embassy in Jerusalem and our senior spokesman. We've been dealing over the past five and a half months now with Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza and other fronts. And we're bringing back one of my favorite guests. He was with us two or three months ago talking about the future of Gaza. But today we're going to talk about the Hamas threat of a Ramadan explosion, an escalation, especially in Judea, Samaria, the West Bank, Jerusalem, that Hamas is trying to incite over the Muslim month of Ramadan. And our guest is Dr. Mordechai Kadar. Good to see you.
Thank you so much, David, for having me here.
Now, Mordechai Kadar is one of Israel's leading scholars on Islam and Arab affairs. He was formerly with Army Military Intelligence. I think that's called AMAL. He was a lecturer at Bar-Ilan University and a fellow with the Basis Center there at Bar-Ilan. And now he's one of the founders of Newsreel. And he really... if you go on YouTube again, I've said it before, he gets on Al Jazeera, all the Arabic news channels, and really gives them the what for about Israel's historic place here in the Middle East and the way things really are. And it's great to have you, Mordechai.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Okay. First, help us understand, as a scholar on Islam, what this... I don't want to call it the holy month of Ramadan, because I think when you use something like this to incite violence and jihad, it's not very holy to you. But what are the traditions around Ramadan? Is it Quranic? Is it Hadith?
Well, it is a Quranic obligation. And actually, one of the five pillars of Islam, the Sawm, as I say in Arabic, means the fast. They fast for a whole month, since the first light, before sunrise, until it's almost totally dark every day, for 29 or 30 days, according to the moon, which they see at the new moon, and the new moon of the next month, then will be the Eid of Eid al-Fitr, means the festive of eating after all month of fasting during the day. During the day, a man and a woman who is not in her period are supposed to fast if they are healthy, if they can bear it. But not only they should refrain from eating, they cannot drink, they cannot smoke, and they cannot have sexual relations as well during the day. Means that the human being is actually leaves all the pleasures of this world, the worldly pleasures, and dedicates himself or herself totally to Allah, to think about his own conduct, to repent from his sins if he had any, to try to be a better Muslim, and because he doesn't deal with food or with smoking with girls. So it leaves the human being with his own accounts with Allah. And this is actually what I would say inflates the religious glands in the bodies of many, many Muslims. Because of this increase of the religious feelings, it might be too much dangerous for the regime, especially if the regime doesn't behave according to the Islamic rules, as it happened too many times during the Islamic time. And when rulers are vicious, when rulers are not going according to the Islamic Sharia, and there were many of those, so it becomes too dangerous, because the population, and now thinking too much or have too much religious adrenaline in their body, in their blood, they might be dangerous for the government. And this is where this idea of resisting anything which doesn't go strictly according to Islam is coming. And this is what makes people, other people, feel a fear from the Ramadan, because the Ramadan, those Muslims might be too dangerous. As a result, the Ottoman Empire, which ruled the Middle East for 400 years, between 1517 and 1917, exactly 400 years, they were announcing every day the beginning of the fast, every early morning, by a shot from a cannon. And the end of the fast, in the evening, also with a shot of a cannon. Why not a gong? Why not with a trumpet? Why not with any other means? They use the cannon in order to remind everybody who is behind the cannon, and the cannon, what the cannon can do to you guys if you dare to pass the red lines of behavior against the rulers. And this is why the Ottoman Empire was using cannons in order to remind everybody about who is behind the cannon and what he can do to them if they dare to challenge his rulership. So this is what happened in many other places. In other places, rulers, in order to get rid of their opponents, were checking if they are fasting. Let's say if you don't eat for some hours, your tongue becomes more bright or white in parts of the tongue. So they would catch their opponents, the political opponents, afternoon, and check their tongues. If the tongues were pink or towards red, they would punish them for eating during the Ramadan, because somebody who fasts, the color of his tongue is with less blood. So this is how Ramadan was used or misused or abused as a tool against political opponents, along with its religious issue.
That's all very interesting, because we even have in Jerusalem, we have the Ramadan cannon that the city of Jerusalem shoots off. You hear it in the evening, and now it's time to eat. They do it for the Arabs, but it may not be the same as Ottoman Turks, but to remind people who's the boss.
No, they don't use the ball. They use only the explosive material, which will make a noise, but they don't want to kill somebody. But everybody should remember that the one who holds the cannon can also use the ammunition as well if he needs to. So this is that. There is no obligation to come to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Nowhere it says in the Islamic Sharia books that Muslims are obliged to come to pray in Al-Aqsa. The whole thing about Al-Aqsa in Jerusalem, first of all, it's a political issue. As I think I said to you in previous interviews, that the whole idea of Al-Aqsa in Jerusalem is a fake news of the 7th century by the Umayyads, yes, who were the opponents of the Hashemites who controlled Mecca. And in order to undermine the centrality of Mecca in the Islamic world, the Umayyads who controlled Jerusalem and the rest of this area declared that the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is mentioned in the Quran, is actually in Jerusalem. However, originally it was not in Jerusalem. It was in near a village named Ju'rana, which is 29 kilometers to the northeast from Mecca. And the Aqsa Mosque, which is mentioned in the Quran, is actually in there, in Ju'rana, in what today Saudi Arabia is. The Umayyads in the 7th century, after 50 years after Muhammad died, moved the idea of Al-Aqsa from Ju'rana to Jerusalem in order to sanctify Jerusalem, in order to challenge the centrality of Mecca in the Islamic world. The Shia, who were the opponents of the Umayyads, did not accept it. And for them, the third place in holiness after Mecca and Medina is the town of Najaf in southern Iraq. So that just to show you that the whole thing about Jerusalem and Islam is political, including today. Because what you see today, the how many thousands of people come to Al-Aqsa during the Ramadan, it is a political issue. No more than political issue, because there is no obligation to come to Jerusalem, to come to Al-Aqsa, or to come in any mosque. Of course, it is better to pray in a mosque, in Jama'ah, would they say, in a group of 40 people. But Jerusalem is not mentioned anywhere in the halachic or the Sharia books of Islam. So this, until today, the Al-Aqsa is used as a political issue between Muslims and between Muslims and others like us when it is here in the state of Israel.
Yeah. Now, it's quite interesting, this whole history behind Ramadan. That is, they call it holy, but there's been a lot of violence and tension even within the Arab world between Muslims themselves, those who are strictly observant and those who aren't. And that's all quite interesting. My own experience, if you go over in East Jerusalem during the month of Ramadan, and you've got a lot of Arabs, a lot of Muslims there who normally they smoke a lot of cigarettes, they drink coffee, but they have to go without all day during the daylight hours. They get a little grumpy and mean and testy, and they're not very friendly. That's just my experience.
Yes, and here it comes to a bigger problem when the Ramadan falls in the summer. And as you know, it happens because the Islamic year is shorter by 11 days from the general year.
So it rotates around our calendar. And happen
right. Every 3 years, it retreats with the whole month, okay. 33 days. So there are years which the Ramadan is in the summer. And here in this part of the world, in the summer, days are first of all hot, so they become thirsty and they need more to drink. Secondly, the days are longer, so the fast could be more than 13 hours because of the days are longer. And as a result, the increase of heart attacks and brain problems blood,
aneurysms, blood clots.
Strokes,
blood clots in your brain.
Blood strokes in the brains are dramatically in an increase during the Ramadan.
But you're not drinking water in the day.
They don't drink, so the blood is stiff.
Congealed.
It's not so liquid.
Yeah.
So as a result, many heart attacks and many strokes happen during the Ramadan, especially in the summer, especially in the Negev, down south, where the Bedouins try not to eat and not to drink during the Ramadan, during the day, and they live in the desert. So this is the damage. But those who pass Ramadan become stiff, and Ramadan is one of the, I would say, the litmus papers of Islam to check who is really loyal to Allah and who is not.
Fundamentalism. Are you back to the fundamentals, the basics?
Yes, that's what they say. And those who keep Ramadan strictly and they don't have any drink or any food, when they die, they go to heaven through a gate named Rayyan, where there is no questioning about your conduct. Means it's enough to fast Ramadan strictly in order to get to heaven without any questions. So people
earning your way in.
Yeah,
okay. All right. Look, the whole background to this particular show is that there was a real sense, Hamas Iran wanted to incite an escalation in violence, trying to get the Arabs, the Muslims in Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank, Jerusalem, the Israeli Arabs behind their war against Israel more over Ramadan, and to try and prevent that or defuse it. There was a real effort to get a hostage deal in place before Ramadan started last Sunday night at sunset. But that didn't happen, but we still have the first Friday day of prayer, Muslim day of prayer, this Friday. Tomorrow, it's the real date here that we're looking at. And what do you expect tomorrow here in Jerusalem? I've seen it after the wave of Hamas suicide bombings in February of 96, that week where there were like five bombings, 70 Israelis killed. Oh, it was the last Friday of Ramadan, and 400,000 Arab Muslims went up to pray. That's the most ever, and it was very scary around here.
Well, this is actually what shows you why Hamas and its allies tried to take advantage of the high voltage of religious feelings and emotions which are embedded in the Ramadan. Look, they also base it on history. During the Islamic history, many victories were achieved by the Muslims during the Ramadan. For example, the Badr fight, the Badr battle in 624, the occupation of Mecca in 630, and recently the Yom Kippur War between Israel and Egypt and Syria. Started on Ramadan. Definitely Ramadan is viewed as the month of victories. So they try to ride this wave of victories and to say, hey, if you only go to the Aqsa and if you, arrange riots against the Jews, of course, in Jerusalem and other places, this will be the final victory over the Jews. So, yes, this is the message. And unfortunately, there are too many people who really fall into this propaganda, thinking that Israel is so easy to be defeated.
I did notice that the IDF itself had started putting out warnings several weeks before they would try to, Hamas would try to use Ramadan to incite violence and an escalation. And I think they actually had intelligence that Iran was very busy, very anxious, eager in recruiting, getting in arms, planning attacks. And over the past 4 or 5 days, right around the start of Ramadan, there were a couple suicide attacks that were thwarted. So it looks like it was right time to for the start of Ramadan. But so far, Israel has intercepted most of these.
First of all, we do have an intelligence, all kinds of intelligence, which allows us to monitor the emotions and the preparations. You have social media, and many people use the social media in order to plan all kinds of things. And I myself am a member in many groups on WhatsApp and Telegram of jihadists, and I do see how they incite people against Israel, and not only against Israel, against Israel's friends in the Middle East. And this is what actually makes Jordan very much worried about what might happen in Jordan because of what happens here. The same thing in Egypt, the same thing in the Emirates, the same thing in, because there are all kinds of people who try to undermine the public stability in these countries, because these states, either they are collaborating with Israel, as they claim about the Emirates and Bahrain and Morocco, or do not act against Israel, especially on the background of what happens in Gaza during the last 5 months. So those who want to attack Israel and its friends and allies do have enough reasons recently to wage this media war against Israel and its friends and allies, and maybe some actions as well.
How do you think the Israeli government is handling this? They say we're going to let the same sort of restrictions as in the past, Israeli Arabs only in certain ages, very few Palestinians from Judea, Israel, from the West Bank can get in there. Have they done the right thing to try and keep this in control?
Well, so far so good. We are on the fourth day of Ramadan, and
tomorrow's the real test, though. Friday, the day of prayer.
Fridays. We have four Fridays during the Ramadan, and then apparently the real ordeal will be on Fridays. Yet the 4 days which passed fairly calm in Jerusalem might be the preamble of a better continuation of Ramadan, and of course things might happen. Let's say even if road accident, which unfortunately will kill some people, might ignite the atmosphere because the atmosphere is very highly charged with emotions and propaganda.
Yeah, it's combining Ramadan and these Friday prayers with the Jerusalem card, the Al-Aqsa card, which is Hamas's best card. It's the only real card they have left to play right now in the wider Muslim world.
By the way, this is what worries the Saudis.
Yeah.
Because today, the centrality of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem in the media, in the social media, is way much higher than the centrality of Mecca. Mm-hmm. And there's some kind of a competition between the Saudis and the Palestinians who will draw more attention to the holy sites of Islam. Who is better jihadist for Islam? Who is the one who really fights the Jews who threaten Islam? So in this case, definitely the Palestinians are taking the lead, and they are beyond proud about this. And Hamas, of course, is the movement which leads this jihad against Israel, and this actually gives them much more legitimacy in the eyes of too many in the Islamic world, especially the sponsors in Iran and in Qatar, and they are rather proud, and they are preparing for the Palestinian state in which they will materialize their power in the public. And don't forget that they already won the legislative elections in 2006. And until this very day, Hamas have the majority of the seats of the Palestinian Legislative Council. Okay, so we should not ignore this thing, and that's actually what they plan. When the Palestinian state will be established, according to especially what the American administration wants, the Hamas will create the Democratic Party of Palestine. This will be the name, or Justice and Development Party, just like it is in Turkey. But they will choose a very nice naming for the party.
A welfare
and of course, who is against democracy? Who is against development? Who is against justice? And this is how they will brand their party in order to win the elections. And here we are. We're going to have another Hamastan in Judea and Samaria if, God forbid, the plan of some people in the American administration will be materialized, and we're going to have a Palestinian state on the hills of Judea and Samaria, let alone the problem of Jerusalem, which those people want us to give the Palestinians East Jerusalem at least.
Okay. Look, Hamas did, after October 7, Israel was bombing Gaza. They haven't quite gone in with ground incursions yet. But Hamas did try to use Al-Aqsa, the Jerusalem issue, to incite an uprising on the first and second Fridays after they started this war on October 7. But it just fizzled it seemed, I think most Arabs in the territories in Israel, in East Jerusalem, they saw the huge Israeli mobilization and they said, Israel's serious. We better not do anything. Do you think anything's changed? I also have noticed over the years, once you hit Ramadan, there's four Fridays usually, and it sort of escalates from one to the next, and that final Friday is like the big, before the feast of the big feast you talked about, Eid al-Fitr, that it's like a gradually ratchets up over the four Fridays of Ramadan.
Don't forget that the name of the whole operation, which started on October 7th, is the Flood of Al-Aqsa. And the flood, as you they relate to the flood, which was mentioned in the Bible in the days of Noah. Mm-hmm. And the idea, why did they name it? Because that flood actually killed all the sinners. Hinting that the Flood of Al-Aqsa will kill the Israelis or the Jews or those who collaborate with them, especially the Christians. So this is the hint, or this is the innuendo behind the naming or the branding of all this war as the Al-Aqsa Flood. So we have also to take this into account, because when people in Judea and Samaria, and maybe in Israel as well, when they hear the flood, they immediately understand what those who branded it in such a way, what they mean, who is the bad guys in this game, and what should be done to the bad guys. So Hamas are good in branding things in Islamic meaningful names in order to incite the people and to make them or to mobilize them according to what Hamas want.
Now, the sort of a Muslim Brotherhood chapter within Israel itself, the northern branch of the Islamic movement in Israel up in Umm al-Farm and the Nazareth area, they usually bus a lot of Arabs up to Al-Quds, up to Jerusalem, and to the Temple Mount over Ramadan on these Fridays. Are you expecting that? Have you seen a lot of chatter about that on the social media you're involved in?
Well, I think this is actually what is happening. Because don't forget, the Sheikh Raed Salah, the head of the northern part of the Islamic movement, one of his epithets is Sheikh Al-Aqsa, means the Sheikh, the leader of Al-Aqsa, one of his namings. He actually built his fame and the reputation on the Al-Aqsa, on his activity against the Israelis and the Jewish visitors on the Temple Mount. He doesn't like Christians as well, although he says it, but he says it in order to make part between the Jews and the Christians. He actually was banned from coming to Mecca because he once said that he's willing to go to Mecca to Hajj in order to bring holy water from the spring named Zamzam, which is in Mecca, in order to bring this glass of water from Mecca to Jerusalem and to pour it into one of the cisterns on the Temple Mount. When the Saudis heard it, they banned him from coming to Hajj, because what he actually wants, he wants to sanctify Al-Aqsa Mosque by the holiness of the Kaaba, of the Zamzam. And so this is what it actually means. So the Saudis told him, you go jump in the lake. You're not going to come here. We are not letting you to come in. Ever since then, he's banned from coming to Hajj. So look how much politics here is involved in all these holy issues in Islam. It's actually, in Islam, there is no part between between religion and politics, between state and church or state and mosque. Mm-hmm. There is no difference, because there are not even two sides of the same coin. This is the same one side of the same coin. Islam is everything. Islam is religion. Islam is politics. Islam is economy. Islam is sociology. Islam is everything. they don't accept the Christian or infidel division between state and church or state and religious issues. They absolutely are against it because they think that if you take the state out of the jurisdiction of Allah, it means that Allah is not omnipotent because he has no authority over the state, economy, or whatever people do not want him to control. Means it actually injures the omnipotence of Allah. And they cannot accept such an idea. Therefore, Islam includes everything, including politics. So here we are. Definitely politics is part of religion. And when Sheikh Raed Salah wants to bring holy water from Mecca to Jerusalem, the Saudis kick him out.
That's all very fascinating. I know he has a lot of street cred among radical Muslims, including a lot of Israeli Arab Muslims, because he served time in Israeli jail for what you said, this incitement against Israel. They've brought him in to interrogate him, and it just increases his standing in some people's eyes.
Look, fortunately, most of the Arabs who are Muslims in Israel understand very well all these foolish shtick, as they say in German, all this spoiled game of Sheikh Raed Salah. However, he does have a minority of people who are rather radical, and they agitate the issues in order to destabilize the state of Israel and to turn life here to hell, just like Hamas did to the Gazans or the other parts of the Muslim Brotherhood organization in many other places, like in Tunisia as well. So this is the way they believe, more or less like the Soviets, that the worse the situation is, the better it is.
Yeah. Look, we'll see how things play out over Ramadan. We're still early in it, and it's hard to predict. But I also think that as around the time Ramadan ends, you're then moving into the Jewish holy season of Passover, Pesach, which there's a lot more Jews wanting to go and pray on the Temple Mount or visit the Temple Mount over that holiday. And this has been a sort of Hamas and others have used this as a an excuse to agitate and all. And I think that's going to be a stiffer test coming up.
Look, living in the Middle East is not a journey or a cruise ship. This area is tough. In order to survive in this area, you have to be tough. You cannot be cute, nice, and peaceful. You have to show your muscles. You have to show your stick. And sometimes you use it. Because, you know, if Israel will be strong and decisive and united, very important, and deterring, it will have temporary peace, as it is customary in the Middle East. Yet, if Israel will be powerful, united, dangerous, and invincible forever, Israel will enjoy temporary peace forever.
Okay. While we have you, I think you've really answered a lot of questions and given us some fascinating information about this whole question of Ramadan. But let me just sort of widen out. Do you think Israel? How much has Israel damaged Hamas in Gaza, and how much of a setback has this war been towards the hope of normalization with the Saudis?
Well, first of all, we have to take into account that the Saudis hate Hamas tremendously. There is a big gap between the Islamic message of the Saudis, which is collected. Islam in Saudi Arabia belongs to the establishment. It's an establishment Islam. Mm-hmm. While the Muslim Brotherhood, and especially Hamas, are a revolutionary Islam against the establishment. And there is no way to bridge between two parts of Islam. This is why this big gap and the hatred between the Saudis and any Muslim Brotherhood organization, especially Hamas, which disobeyed the Saudis in 2007. Therefore, the Saudis implicitly, and they will not say it out loud, for them, the more decisive Israel against Hamas is, the better it is for the Saudis. Yet they cannot say it, because after all, it is a war and Muslims are being killed, and let alone the pictures of the civilians, those who allegedly are not connected to Hamas. So they cannot support it overtly. Yet the Saudis do wait for the end of the war on Gaza with a very clear Israeli victory, which will leave Hamas out of Gaza altogether. Let's hope that Israel will continue its campaign over Rafah. Of course, try not to make the cost of too many people in Gaza who are there in order to find asylum, not in order to be victims for the IDF. And I definitely would try to reduce as much as possible the number of casualties within civilians. Yet Israel has to be very decisive when it comes to Hamas forces, to the three, I think, brigades of Hamas who are still functioning in Rafah, and especially against Sinwar, who holds the hostages in order to protect himself. This should be the Israeli goal in the coming weeks, months, to get rid of Hamas on both the military and the civil levels, in order to enable better groups to come or to emerge from the ruins of Gaza. And I'm talking about the clans. And this is something which definitely needs a whole session in order to explain why in the Middle East, clannish countries like Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Kuwait, Qatar, Oman, Saudi Arabia are successful, while states like Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Libya, Sudan, Yemen are failures. And when you base a state on a clan, this is a very good chance that the state will be successful, peaceful, and prosperous. While if you base a state on different things, which are brought from the West, especially ideologies, you get a mayhem, like Syria, like Lebanon, or like Iraq. For this, we will need the whole session. And if you want in the future, I'll be more than happy to speak about this.
Yeah, I know you've been talking about this. We'll come back to you on it. I know it's similar to what Dario Sharon proposed, I think, in the 70s, the League of Village Elders.
And it worked very well.
Until they got threats like to be shot by the terror group.
It was shot by people who did not understand the Middle East at all, like Peres and Beilin and Alon Liel and many others. And I highly recommend to read Peres's book, The New Middle East, in order to see how mistaken the man was when he thought that the Middle East is more or less like Israel. They want more as like what we want. And everybody in the Middle East wants good life, prosperity, good health, good education, and a swimming pool in his backyard. No, the Middle East is totally different. And unfortunately, Peres was leading this country and leading its foreign policy basing on hallucinations about the Middle East rather than the reality.
Okay. We'll revisit this with you in the coming weeks. We'll come back to you on this. It sounds very fascinating. I remember talking, I asked a question of Sharon one time when I had some time with him about that League of Village Elders and using the Mukhtars, the clan leaders, or village leaders, to as the framework basis for governing self-autonomy. Just one more question. You've got the Israeli flag and another flag in the background. It's not so familiar. Tell us about it.
Yes, this is a flag of a district named Ahwaz, the Arabic-speaking district of Iran. These Ahwazis are fighting for freedom, for independence, for sovereignty, because they were occupied by the Persians in 1925, and they called themselves the occupied territories. Okay?
It's in
but they are not alone.
Southwest Iran along the coast, right?
Right, which overlooks the Persian Gulf.
Yes.
The same thing with the Kurds in northwest Iran. The same thing with the Azerbaijanis in north Iran. The same thing with the Turkmens in the northeastern Iran. And, of course, the Balochis in the southeast of Iran. They all are fighting for freedom. And from this honorable pulpit, I call upon everybody in the civilized world to support the plight of those minorities for independence, sovereignty, and dignity, because they are humiliated by the Persians and by the Iranian state. Just like what happened with the Soviet Union, which fell apart according to ethnic lines, the same thing with Yugoslavia, the same with the Czechoslovakia, the same thing should happen in Iran, where all the minorities should be honored and be given independence to build their own ethnic states rather than being subjugated to the Persian hegemony, which most of the people in Iran hate totally.
The Balkanization of Iran, a way to get rid of the radical Islamic regime there, which I'm sure they're not happy with that flag when you appear on Arab TV.
Yeah, they accuse me personally, they mention my name, as the one who is responsible for the rebellion of the Ahwazis, of the Arabs who live in Iran. Oh, okay, you know, I bear this blame with pride.
Yeah. All right, well, we thank you for your time, Dr. Mordechai Kadar, formerly at Bar-Ilan University. He's now with Newsreel, one of Israel's leading scholars on Islam and Arab affairs. It's always great to have you. Your wealth of information and insights into what's going on. And thank you very much. I learned a lot today from you, Mordechai.
Thank you so much, David, for having me.
I'm sure everyone else did. We're glad you tuned in. And join us next week, 3 o'clock on Thursday, Israel time, for another episode of our ICJ webinar series. Also at the top of the hour, 4 o'clock, Jerusalem time, join us for our global prayer gathering today. It's a daily global prayer gathering where more than 1,000 Christians are coming together every day to pray for Israel and the region during this difficult time. So be with us then, and see you next time on the ICJ webinar.